All right, has everyone inwardly signed? It's fine if you want to wait until after class today, but that'll be the only time you're allowed to do that. I'll talk about that in a minute. First day is always the worst day because people are kind of not relaxed yet. But one good thing about the fact that I teach so many courses is that I have a lot of students that I have in multiple times. That's true of this. Most of you have had the pleasure or displeasure of having me in another course. The rest of you are rookies. Probably have already figured out that I'm Ty Hoffman. And we're here for biochemistry. Has everyone had at least 3 semesters of calculus? Anyone not? It's not necessary. I just like math, so I encourage you to have that much. You won't need any calculus in this course. I'm not going to spend a hell of a lot of time on the syllabus because you can read a syllabus. But most people usually want to have at least a little bit of a overview. Really, technically, you should have already read this. Has anyone done that? Show off. The point distribution is what most people care about. And as you see here, there's not all that many sources of points. There's only really 2 that you can consider to be assignments. The 5 lecture examinations, which will, I expect, to be the lowest scoring of the bunch. I mean, that's the way it usually happens. I'd like you to get all 100s, but it's never come close to happening. Those are going to be the majority of your final grade notice, 60% from my lecture exams. And so that means, obviously, that you need to prepare for those very well. But, and I usually don't have to tell people that because something about the word exam spells importance in people's minds. But what I'm trying to get through to you is that the other 40% of your grade, which is a huge chunk, is a lot easier. And therefore, you should not do anything to jeopardize any of those points. The assignments, which you'll be doing on Blackboard, are open book assignments. And so as long as you have the discipline to give yourself enough time in your schedule to do each one of these twice, because I give you 2 abilities or 2 chances to do them, and I'm only going to count the higher of the 2 scores. As long as you give yourself enough time not only to do the entire unit's worth, notice that each unit or each test's worth of material features a certain number of chapters, all of whose quizzes become due simultaneously. If you wait till the last minute, it's going to take a while to get through them, first of all. But you're also just not going to do as well. You got to give yourself time to do them and to look up things that you're not sure of right away just by reading the question. That's the whole open book nature. So if you're able to do that, you can get close to 100% on all these quizzes, and that will go a long way toward giving you the score that you are hoping for, the grade you're hoping for, I should say, at the end. So don't jeopardize any of that, especially because I am going to be a hard ass about lateness on these quizzes. There's going to be no lateness. I mean, it just turns into a 0 at that second, which is always 9 o'clock. In other words, the start time for when we meet. You already have to have them in by then. So there's no exceptions to that. Just realize that right now and plan ahead. All right? Those are the 2 things that you do as assignments. The rest of it, which is 15% total, is being here and participating. When I, you know, I'm not going to call on people to answer questions, but I like to ask questions just to get a feel for how much you have forgotten in your scholastic career. And you should not be afraid to chime in. Typically, it's the same two or three people answering all my questions. That doesn't make for a good participation score for everyone else. So notice it's just participation. It's not participation with knowledge. You don't have to be correct. Give it a stab. I don't understand why people are afraid to participate. I mean, the typical reason is they're afraid that they're wrong, which doesn't really make sense to me as an instructor, because if all of you knew all the answers to everything I'm going to ask you already, why the hell would you take this course? Right? You could just test out of it. So the fact that you're here really publicly says, I don't know everything yet about biochemistry. And so it's no great embarrassment if you say something that you think is right and it ends up being wrong. So don't be afraid to participate. Makes this a class. And by the way, when you do participate, speak about the same volume I'm speaking right now so that everyone can hear you. That's usually a problem as well. All right, so anyway, I don't think there's much confusion about how your points are going to be awarded. Just appreciate how big a chunk each one is. And like I said, plan for the quizzes. I'm not going to send out any reminders for that. If you don't have to print out this whole syllabus, but if you do print out any of it, it would be this page. Keep an eye on all these deadlines. All right, so is there anything, I mean, I want you to read the whole syllabus on your own, but is there anything you can't wait to find out right now before we get into actual science? Okay. And I noticed that not everyone has yet submitted the required rules consent form. You don't get any scores at all until you do that. So do that today if you haven't already done it. Let's go to biochemistry then. And this first chapter, as you might expect, is the easiest chapter in the term, easiest chapter in the book. It really should be a review of things that you've done before. The prerequisites for this course are 181 and 353, right? So you're supposed to have already gone through and learned the stuff in 181 and 353. General biology and cell biology, which are, in a sense, they are different names for the same course. I teach both of them. And so what I notice is that, well, there's a huge overlap between Bio 181 and Bio 353, which should make sense, right? Bio 181 as opposed to Bio 182 is biology at the cellular level. 182 is outside the cell, bigger stuff. And so what happens at the cell level is obviously going to be a big overlap with a course that's called cell biology, right? And that's important. It's actually you're lucky, in a sense, for getting to receive credit for both of them because they're largely the same class, largely the same course. But what I've found since I teach both of them is that that's a good thing that you're actually taking the same material over again, because when I teach Bio 353, I notice that there's a lot of information that is fundamental stuff, important stuff, which is what 181 is, that people don't remember. I mean, that's true for any course that you take. You're going to forget most of the material. That's just the way humans are. But 181 is basic biology, which does not at all mean easy biology. It means important biology. It's the fundamentals. It's the stuff that all the other courses rely on. So getting a chance to learn that again, which will hopefully make it a deeper learning, but still get credit for it, is what cell biology is all about. Well, what happens in a cell, though, is at the chemical level, right? It's chemistry that's happening in cells. And so there's, once again, a lot of overlap between those two courses and this. Not as much, but still a lot of overlap. And so this chapter really features a quick rundown of what you have learned in 181 and 353. And hopefully still remember, but probably you don't remember all of this. So I'm going to go through it again. We're looking at a table in slide one. And by the way, since I record all my lectures, which are important to listen to do well in this course, that takes some time too. So you really have to budget your time to do well in this course. And part of that budgeting is to take time to listen to my recordings, because that is by far the most important thing to use to study for exams. And you should not at all use the quizzes as a way for studying for the exams, because those are publisher questions that I did not write. They might just coincidentally be stuff that is the same material as my questions on my exams, but you should not use them as a way of studying. They're an entirely separate batch of points, and that's why I have them due after the test, not before. But anyway, when I deliver my lectures, for the sake of the recordings, I always make a point of saying what slide I'm on so that you can follow this at home, which is what you should do. But I encourage you to write old-fashioned notes, not print out the slideshows and write beside them, but I'm not going to police that. Anyway, you should make a note of what slide we're on, draw a line each time I switch slides. That'll make it a lot better to make very good notes, which will be important to do well. In this first slide, though, we're looking at a table that shows you the makeup in terms of elements for humans, just as a representative, just because we are humans, but really the numbers for humans aren't going to be drastically different from any organism you might choose. Shows you what we're made of, basically, in terms of elements. Who wants to tell me what an element is, by the way, just to start out with some basics? It's a good softball question. Now that is damn fine participation. So everyone has a zero so far. Yeah, go ahead. They are the building blocks, but you could say the same thing for atoms. So how can you refine that so that you're defining an element? Yeah. Well, it depends. So no, not necessarily. Anyone else? Well, let me try. An element is a substance made of atoms all having exactly the same number of protons. All right? Now, I could say it's a substance made of all the same kind of atom, but technically, that's not even necessarily true, because there can be the different kinds of atoms having the same number of protons. What do we call such things? Isotopes, right. You can have multiple different isotopes of the same element. But what makes oxygen oxygen, an oxygen atom? What makes it an oxygen atom? There's one thing that makes it an oxygen atom only. What is that? The fact that it has exactly 8 protons. Right. That's the only thing that makes oxygen oxygen. Now, a neutral oxygen atom is going to have 8 electrons as well, and that's what is the basis of its neutrality, right? The same number of negative charges as positive charges. But not all oxygen particles necessarily have 8 electrons, right? Atoms can gain or lose electrons. That doesn't change what element they are, because it doesn't change the number of protons. But when we change the number of electrons, either increasing or decreasing, we're creating ions, right? So isotopes, ions are all versions of the same element as long as you haven't messed with that number of protons. And chemistry, normal chemistry, does not mess with the number of protons. Chemistry is all about what happens when two atoms come into contact. Well, what are the outermost pieces of atoms? Electrons. And so that's what really interact in chemistry. Chemistry is all about what happens to electrons when atoms come together. And biochemistry is all about that occurring in organisms. Well, anyway, back to this figure, we see that organisms, not just humans, but organisms in general, are mostly just 3 elements. There's over 100 elements, and it increases slowly, the number, because we keep synthesizing elements. They last in a ridiculously short amount of time. The ones that are in the hundreds. So there's about 90 naturally occurring elements, but only a small minority of those are what make you up. You do have a lot of elements in you, but most of them are a tiny fraction in terms of your overall makeup. Most of you, by far, is just these three at the top, hydrogen, oxygen, and carbon. Now, the first two should make sense to you. Why do you have so much hydrogen and oxygen in you? Because you are mostly water, right? Organisms are mostly water, and water is nothing but hydrogen and oxygen, right? It's H2O. Carbon makes sense as well, because along with that water, which is a small molecule, there are a bunch of macromolecules that make up organisms, larger molecules, biomolecules that are macromolecules, and those are all organic. Organic, of course, means carbon-containing nowadays. It was originally called that because early on, chemists thought that there was a fundamental difference between the stuff that you find in organisms versus the stuff that you find in non-organisms. So they called those the things that you get out of organisms organic material, and they didn't think it was possible to make organic material out of inorganic material. Well, we realized a while ago that that's not only possible, it's pretty easy, and it's done all the time now, but we still use the word organic. By the way, speaking of things in the universe, which I didn't bring up, but let me bring that up. There are three kinds of objects in the universe, one of which are living things. What are the other two? Yeah.
Like non-living viruses.
Non-living is another one. And what's the third?
Bacteria
are living. Well, a bacterium could be living. Viruses are, you could argue about this. It depends on whether you want to, actually I say that they're not living because life is chemistry and they're not really undergoing any chemistry. But what is something that's not living or non-living? It's the only other possible category. Well, no, that would still be living. When you're kind of living, though, what's about to happen? You're dying, right? So the third category is dead things. There are living things, non-living things, and dead things. Dead things are not non-living things, right? Dead things are things that used to live and no longer are. Non-living things have never been alive. So the non-living things are not what we care about in this course. It's the living and the dead things, all of which are organically based because they're biomolecules, they're macromolecules, are all carbon-containing, and that explains why you have a bunch of carbon in you. What's the special thing about carbon, chemically speaking? It has tetravalence, yes. A valence of four, exactly. And that means that it's able to make four bonds, right? In order to satisfy its valence. And so in a complete molecule, you'll have every carbon making four bonds. The reason that is so special is because it gives it more versatility than most atoms. When you're able to make four bonds, you can make four individual bonds. You can make two double bonds. You can make a triple bond and a single bond. Even if you just restrict yourself to single bonds, you can make four single bonds with four copies of the same thing, four different things, any combination. So there's all kinds of ways that you can get carbon together with other atoms in organic molecules. And by the way, what's a molecule? Yeah.
Combination of atoms bonded together.
You mean like sodium chloride? Exactly. There aren't any molecules of salt. Sodium chloride is not a molecule. Right. Right. A molecule is a particle featuring multiple atoms bonded together via covalent bonds. And what sort of things form covalent bonds? On the periodic table, what sorts of things? Nonmetals, the things that you find in the upper right-hand corner of the periodic table, which includes oxygen, carbon, and nitrogen in that first period. The rows are the periods, the columns are the groups in the periodic table, right? So carbon is not the only thing with tetravalence. Anything in that group is going to have tetravalence, right? Because things in the same group have similar chemical properties, including the one just below it, right? But what's special about carbon in that group? And why is that true? It's at the top of the periodic table, at the top of the column, the top of the group that has tetravalence. In other words, it's the smallest tetravalent atom. And therefore, when it forms its bonds, since it's smaller in radius, those bonds are stronger than other tetravalent atoms' covalent bonds are with whatever atoms it bonds to. All right, so that's the primary basis for the specialness of carbon. It's tetravalence and the fact that it's the smallest of the tetravalent atoms. Nitrogen is in there. Notice that you already take a pretty big reduction in the amount of stuff you're made of when you get past carbon. Those four, though, hydrogen, oxygen, carbon, and nitrogen, are the biggies. Nitrogen is much smaller than the other three, though, in terms of how much is in you, because it's not in everything. So this brings up, I've been talking about biological macromolecules. There are four categories of macromolecules, and so who wants to give me those? You don't have to raise your hand. Did you say polypeptide? Mm-hmm. Yes, polypeptides is one of them. Proteins consist of polypeptides, at least one, possibly more. But you could also call them proteins. Lipids is another. Polysaccharides instead of carbohydrates, because a carbohydrate isn't necessarily big. Glucose, for instance, is a carbohydrate, but it's not a macromolecule. It's a small molecule, right? The group of carbohydrates is bigger than the group that qualifies as a macromolecule. It includes more, right? Polysaccharides is the third, and what's the one we haven't mentioned?
Nucleic acids,
right. Why are they called nucleic acids? Because they're found in the nucleus, right? At least some of them are. The chief one, the DNA, is, if you're talking about a eukaryotic organism. Well, anyway, this is the chemical basis for why we're made up of mostly these four elements, and then a bunch of other elements as well, but most of them are in tiny amounts, necessary still, so you suffer if you don't have them, but they're not involved in every molecule, so that's why you don't have a bunch of them in your body. All right, so in slide two, we're looking at a protein that is being made up from its subunits. And so we just mentioned these four macromolecules. Three of those qualify officially as polymers. Which one of the four does not qualify as polymers? Lipids don't. Lipids are not only smaller in general than the other macromolecules, even though they can be fairly large molecules. More importantly, the reason that they are not polymers is that they are not put together the same way. A polymer is put together by stringing together either unbranchedly or branchedly multiple subunits in a repeating fashion. Now, it doesn't have to be the same subunit that you keep using. That's not what I mean by repeating. But in terms of how the bonds are formed, that's a repeating pattern. Lipids are not made that way, so they're not. They're macromolecules. At least I consider them to be macromolecules, but they are not polymers. Any polymer, though, It's called a polymer simply because it's made of many parts. That's what it literally means, right? Poly means many. Mer means part. And so the subunits of a polymer are called what? Monomers in general. So each of the three polymer classes has its own types of monomers. And as you see here, for proteins or polypeptides, the monomers are amino acids. What are the monomers for polysaccharides? Monosaccharides, right. And nucleic acids? Nucleotides. But when you get together a bunch of nucleotides, you can also call that thing, instead of a nucleic acid, a polynucleotide. So they're all monomers making up polymers, but they're different types of monomers in each of the three classes. Proteins, well, I mean, you can't live without any of these four macromolecules. They're all important in their own right. But proteins are definitely the most versatile of the four. Proteins do just about all the important jobs in a cell. Or at least they are involved in every important process. They have such great versatility, meaning that their functions are so variable, because they're able to have just about any shape you can come up with. The reason that they have such a highly variable shapes is because there are 20 different kinds of monomers that organisms use to make their proteins, right? 20 different amino acids. Now, I should qualify that and say that there are 20 biological amino acids. There's no limit to the number of amino acids that exist or that you can create in a laboratory, because to be an amino acid, you just have to have a certain structure that we'll talk about more later. But there's 20 that have come to be used by organisms, and when you make a necklace, basically, and you have 20 beads to work with, and you have no limit to the length of the necklace, there's an astronomically high number of ways that you can choose 20 beads one at a time, choose from 20 beads one at a time, and string them together. Therefore, there's really no limit to the number of different proteins, each with its own shape, because that shape, as you see here in this slide, depends on the sequence of those amino acids to begin with. When the polypeptide is built, it's going to have a certain sequence, and whatever that sequence of amino acids is going to determine how it folds up in three dimensions, which is when we call it a protein. Proteins, regardless of their function, which is really various, that function depends on it, on the protein shape or conformation. Now, just to give you an idea of the variety of functions that proteins perform, well, they act as receptors, for instance, so they can receive signals from outside of the cell and relay that signal into the cell. They act as signals themselves. Most of the signals that proteins operating as receptors receive are themselves proteins. They act as channels in membranes, or as carrier proteins. They're structural elements, right? All kinds of things that proteins do, but if you were to think about your thousands of different proteins you are able to produce in your body, what do more than half of them do? What is the function of most of your proteins? Act as enzymes, exactly. And those we'll talk a lot about in this course, because a lot of biochemistry is thinking about how pathways work one at a time. Each individual reaction in a pathway is catalyzed by its own enzyme, which is some sort of protein. All right, so let's go to slide 3, and what we're looking at is ATP, obviously adenosine triphosphate. It's an example of what? It is a nucleotide. And the word nucleotide really is a little bit ambiguous. A nucleotide, though, any given nucleotide, has to contain three things. See all of them in different colors here. One of those is some sort of base, a nitrogen-containing or nitrogenous base, is shown in blue here, connected to a pentose sugar, shown in black here. Now, why is it called a pentose? Because there are five carbons in it, right? Each corner, if it's not labeled otherwise, is a carbon, right? So 1, 2, 3, 4, and then 5. Which specific pentose is this? This is ribose, right? So anyway, you have a pentose sugar, that's one of the three components. Stuck to that is one of the other components, which is a nitrogenous base. And then also stuck to the sugar, shown in pink here, or magenta, is some number of phosphate groups. And that's why I say it's kind of ambiguous. It's some number of phosphate groups, at least one, for it to be a nucleotide. So since, because of that ambiguity, it's sometimes instructive to think about what we have just as the sugar and the nitrogenous base by itself without any of the phosphates. What do we call just the black and the blue here, if that's all we had together? That's a nucleoside, right. And therefore, by using that terminology, we can specify this particular nucleotide as not only being a nucleotide, but more specifically, a nucleoside triphosphate, because that way it tells you how many phosphates are in it. ATP is a particularly important nucleoside triphosphate because it is the chief energy-carrying molecule in cells. You know it as the energy currency of the cells, how it's often depicted. It's not the only one. GTP is another important one, right? GTP differs only in the fact that you have guanine instead of adenine here in, as the nitrogenous base. But that's one important use of nucleotides, specifically nucleoside triphosphates. They carry energy. They temporarily store energy because there's energy that can be released when you break the phosphoanhydride bonds that hold two adjacent phosphates together in a nucleotide. And that's why when you spend this thing in terms of energy, what you'll have after cleaving off one of the phosphates is adenosine diphosphate. You can still use it for some energy, right? Because you can cleave off another one and you'll have adenosine monophosphate. They're all three nucleotides, but of differing energy quantity. That's one use of nucleotides. Of course, the other is as monomers for nucleic acids or polynucleotides. What kind of nucleic acid is ATP used for? RNA, because the pentose is particularly, or specifically, ribose. So ATP, along with the other three nucleotides that are used to make RNA, get their phosphates cleaved off, leaving one only, so that when you string them together, you have an RNA molecule. If you're making DNA, you would be using a very similar thing, but it would be deoxy-ATP, right? It wouldn't have this oxygen. So it would be deoxyribose instead of ribose. All right, so two important uses of nucleotides. And in slide four, we see the polymer version. When you string together a bunch of nucleotides, you can make a nucleic acid. Well, if you're using nucleotides featuring deoxyribose as your pentose and you string them together, you'll make a DNA polynucleotide, right? Which would be one strand of the two that occur in an overall DNA molecule. Strictly speaking, you really have two molecules in what we usually call one molecule of DNA, because each polynucleotide is officially its own molecule. One strand is a complete molecule, the other one is a complete polynucleotide molecule as well. And what holds them together are not chemical bonds, but hydrogen bonds, right? What holds the two strands of DNA together are weak hydrogen bonds between nitrogenous bases occupying the same position but on opposite strands. what really holds the strands together has nothing to do at all with the nitrogenous bases, right? What holds them together are the covalent bonds, which is why it's a molecule, between adjacent nucleotides. Covalent bond between the pentose of one nucleotide and the phosphate of the next nucleotide, which is why it's called the sugar phosphate backbone. Those sugar phosphate backbones, one for each polynucleotide in the overall DNA, are shown here in different color ribbons. The blue ribbon and the pink ribbon represent the sugars, the phosphates, sugar, phosphate, all the way down the line. That's what holds the thing together along its length. But the little pegs here, the rods, represent the nitrogenous bases, which are much more weakly held together by hydrogen bonds. Now, speaking of DNA, if you were to ask people just from the street, never have had a biology course maybe, they definitely have heard of DNA, though, because it's one of the most famous molecules. And so people that really don't know biology would likely say that DNA is in control of everything in your body, which is kind of true, but actually it's not so true. There are two major functions of DNA, though. What are the two functions of DNA? What is it? Well, storing genetic information is definitely a function of DNA, but that's true for both of its major processes that it's involved in. And so these processes are what I'm calling the major functions of DNA. What are those two processes? Transcription is one, and replication, self-replication. That's what DNA does. And the self-replication part is not so important in the lifetime of a cell, but it's important for the lifetime of the two cells that one cell is going to split into. All right? So at the end of the lifetime of a cell, that's when self-replication becomes important, so that there are two copies of DNA, one for each of the two cells that will be created after the split. But during the lifetime of that cell, before it ends its own life by splitting, the important thing about DNA is transcription. And transcription, of course, refers to using genes, reading the sequences that are in genes. Transcription always produces what? What is it? Not necessarily mRNA, no. Sometimes it's mRNA, but that's why I stress the word always. You were too specific. It makes always RNA. So there are genes in your body, 20,000 or so genes. All of them are genes, as opposed to the stretches of DNA that are not considered genes, which is most of your DNA. Anyway, those genes are called genes because they are instructions for how to build an RNA molecule. Now, the majority of those genes specify how to make an mRNA molecule, particularly, as opposed to other kinds of mRNA. So those ones are called the protein-coding genes because mRNA is used to go on to another process that doesn't involve DNA, right? Translation, in order to assemble a polypeptide out of the correct order and types of amino acids. So the end product is a protein in that case. That's why we call them protein-coding genes. You have a bunch of other genes, though, that don't make mRNA, or they don't code for mRNA. They code for the other kinds of RNA that your body needs. There's all kinds of different categories of RNA, like ribosomal RNA, microRNA, transfer RNA, and so on. Those things don't just pop into existence. The cell needs an instruction set for how to build those RNAs as well. So you have non-protein coding genes as well, coding for the other kinds of RNA, but they're still genes. Don't confuse non-protein coding gene with non-coding DNA. Non-coding DNA doesn't code for anything. So it's those intervening sequences between genes doing whatever the case is. It does various stuff, including maybe nothing that we have learned at least yet. Okay, let's go on. Slide 5 is an example of a lipid. Now, this is just one type of lipid, but it's a It's impossible to overstate the importance of this kind of lipid. What is this thing? This is a phospholipid. It's one kind of membrane lipid. There are three major classes of membrane lipids: phospholipids, glycolipids, and sterols. Each of those, there's many different kinds of, but they're all components of biological membranes, which is truly important for biology, of course, but that's not the only lipids that you have. There are also triacylglycerols. What is another name for a triacylglycerol? A fat. That's the easiest one to spell. You could also call it a triglyceride. Those all mean the same thing. Fats, which there are also many different versions of, are really important for other reasons besides being membrane components. They're really important for the storage of energy because they have a very high energy density. So if you take in extra energy as more food than you need, whether it's fat or not that you eat, you're going to deposit that in your body as fat because you can store it a lot more efficiently. If we stored our energy as carbohydrate or as protein, we would weigh a lot more than we do because it would take more mass to contain that same amount of energy. So we store it as fat. But fat is also important because it's padding for the body, and it's also a good thermal insulator. So it keeps you either cool or warm, depending on what the surroundings are. But in terms of the origin of life, the whole reason that we're here, in other words, the whole reason that first cell existed, is because of phospholipids' role in being a constituent of the phospholipid bilayer, which is the main substructure making up a plasma membrane. Every cell has a plasma membrane, right? Now, the specific kinds of molecules that make up that plasma membrane differ from species to species, but not wildly. The point, though, is that phospholipids form this membrane just purely because of chemical reasons. They do this in the absence of life. They arrange themselves in this bilayer entirely on their own, for reasons that we'll talk about in another chapter. But if it weren't for that, if it weren't for plasma membranes, there would be no organisms. What is an organism, by the way?
Something living?
Living things are organisms. But what's the mere requirement for being an organism?
That's carbon-based?
No, diamond is carbon-based. Graphite is. They're both inorganic, by the way, even though they're nothing but carbon. They are inorganic. Yes, it does. But what is it that membrane actually allows us to call that whole thing? A cell, yes. An organism is something that has at least one cell, which is why a virus is definitely not an organism. A virus is made out of biological macromolecules, but it's not an organism. It's much smaller than something than a cell, and in fact it has to invade a cell in order for it to do anything. It has to co-opt the machinery within the cell to do the job of creating new viruses. Okay, let's go to 7 now, and this is just a picture of glucose, which is the master fuel. It's the most abundant, it's the most often used fuel in not only your cells, but all cells. It's an example, though, of a carbohydrate, which, remember, isn't necessarily a macromolecule. Glucose is not a macromolecule. We don't use macromolecules directly as fuels. We can get energy out of macromolecules if we first break them down into small enough subunits so that those can operate as fuels. And that's what we do with polysaccharides. Functionally speaking, there are two major groups of polysaccharides, depending on what they're used for. And those are storage polysaccharides, and structural polysaccharides. Structural polysaccharides are pretty self-explanatory. The polysaccharides serve the purpose of forming some sort of structure. And they are there for the same reason that we would have structural proteins. Storage polysaccharides are so called, though, because what is being stored in that polysaccharide is energy in the form of monosaccharides that have been strung together to make up that storage polysaccharide. And storage polysaccharides are therefore made out of stringing together not just any monosaccharides, but specifically the most important fuel monosaccharide, glucose. So when you string together a bunch of glucoses, you can do that for the purpose of keeping those glucoses for fuel to be used later, but storing them in a way that's more efficient in the cell while they're not being used as fuel. This is the fuel itself, though. You can get that fuel back out of the storage polysaccharide by breaking the bonds that you formed when you strung them together. That gets you glucose back, and then glucose can go into the glycolytic pathway, glycolysis, and maybe even on through cellular respiration to get as much energy as possible, usable energy out of that in the form of ATP. Slide 8 is a picture of what animals chiefly do with their glucose when they make a storage polysaccharide. So there are storage polysaccharides in animals and plants. Not to say that those are the only two kinds of organisms, but we kind of focus on those two groups. We make slightly different versions of our storage polysaccharides, though. What do we as animals make? What is this stuff? Glycogen, right. Bacteria can make this as well. This G, by the way, we can worry about later. It's a glycogenin molecule that has to be there to begin with in order to add on to it. But all the little hollow beads are glucose molecules that have been strung together one by one. And this is for the purpose of just keeping these glucoses for later use as fuel. What's different about glycogen, the animal version, and the main plant version, which is what? What is the main plant version? Starch. Is that glycogen is more highly branched. Starch doesn't have as many branches as glycogen, but it's still, they are both examples of a polysaccharide that's made out of nothing but glucose. All right, let's go on to 9. This is something that's called the central dogma. And it describes the flow of information in living systems or organisms. Now, what we see here by the arrows flowing is that information flows from DNA to RNA and then to proteins. This, of course, assumes we're talking about a protein-coding gene, right? If we're talking about a non-protein-coding gene, it would be from DNA to RNA and it would end there. But for a protein-coding gene, there's information in the gene itself, that's the DNA, that's used in order to make another information-carrying molecule, messenger RNA, whose information is then used in the process of translation to assemble a polypeptide out of amino acids. The circular arrow indicates that DNA is also able to undergo its other important process. Besides transcription, it's also able to undergo self-replication. Two different processes for different reasons, but they're similar in terms of how the chemistry works. We'll talk about those later. This was taken as dogma, which is why Crick named it the central dogma, kind of patted himself on the back there saying, I'm going to call this the central dogma. But anyway, there have since been exceptions to this. In other words, information can flow in the other direction, from RNA to DNA instead. What's the enzyme that's necessary for that? Yes, reverse transcriptase, which some viruses have. Retroviruses work by using reverse transcriptase to make DNA out of the information that's in RNA, reverse in that direction. But usually it's this way. Well, speaking of self-replication, slide 10 shows you this process. The original DNA is shown to the right here. The big yellow thing is an enzyme, one of several different kinds of DNA polymerase, which is aptly named because its job is to polymerize a new DNA molecule. In other words, to create a new DNA polynucleotide by stringing together DNA nucleotides under the direction of the code that's in the original DNA. And so this is where the double-stranded nature of DNA pays off. DNA is not just double-stranded, but each of its two strands is complementary to the other strand, right? Obeying strict complementarity rules, A with T always, C with G always, right? Of those four nitrogenous base types. Because of that strict complementarity, if you take one of the two strands, if you take the two strands apart, break those hydrogen bonds, and don't let me see one of those two strands, I can still tell you exactly what the sequence is by looking at the one I still have, right? In other words, each individual DNA polynucleotide is able to serve as a template for how to build the other one. This picture, though, also brings up the important notion that in order for DNA to do either of its two major jobs, transcription or replication, you need to separate the strands, at least locally. In the case of transcription, you don't separate them entirely, but you separate them at a gene, one gene at a time, right? In other words, you can't read the code. You can't get to the information unless you break the hydrogen bonds that are holding the two strands together, because you're reading one strand at a time when you're reading the code that's in that information. In other words, this is why it's really important that the two strands are not held together covalently. Those hydrogen bonds that hold the two strands together are very weak, but there's a hell of a lot of them because there's millions of nucleotides in one polynucleotide. One chromosome is millions of base pairs long. And so when you multiply not very much by millions, it's still quite a force. It holds them together nicely. But when it comes time to separate them at a certain location, like a gene or at an origin of replication, then it's not so hard to break those hydrogen bonds because they are hydrogen bonds, which are by nature weak. You don't want the strands to fall apart, though. You want the strands to separate from each other, but you don't want one strand to fall apart into individual nucleotides because then you have lost the information. So that's why it's important for the sugar phosphate backbone to be covalent, not just with hydrogen bonds. Separating the two strands will still allow the two strands to be intact, each with its information intact. All right, well, the other major use of DNA is shown in slide 11. This is transcription. It also involves a polymerase molecule because it, once again, polymerizes. But this is an RNA polymerase rather than a DNA polymerase because what you're making is RNA instead of DNA. It stands to reason. So the green stuff here is the RNA that's being produced. If this is a protein coding gene, then this is specifically mRNA. But if it's a non-protein coding gene, it could be rRNA or tRNA and so on. Slide 12. DNA is not involved in translation, but if transcription is occurring at a protein coding gene, then you're specifically making messenger RNA, and therefore the transcription is not the end process. It's the beginning of two processes, right? You have translation following. DNA is not directly involved, but DNA is necessary because you have to have the mRNA to undergo translation, and that mRNA doesn't just pop into existence. It was created because of the code that's in DNA in the previous step. This translation process produces a polypeptide. Depending on what the sequence of nucleotides are in the messenger RNA. So obviously messenger RNA is involved, protein is produced, but protein and other kinds of RNA are also required for this process. What other kinds of RNA? Transfer RNA or tRNA. Ribosomal RNA, which is part of this two-piece ribosome. But a ribosome is more than just rRNA. It's also proteins complexed with this rRNA. So there are proteins and RNA in this thing, the ribosome, which are required to read this RNA, the messenger RNA, in order to tell the cell which tRNA is not shown here to come in here bringing their amino acids so that you can assemble the proper polypeptide. All right, now a little bit more about membranes. This is slide 13, and we can see a phospholipid bilayer here in cartoon form on the right, which will self-arrange, as I said, into this bilayer in the presence of water. If you have sterile water, no life in it, and you put in just a few trillion phospholipid molecules, still no life, then they will actually arrange themselves into this bilayer just for reasons of hydrophobicity. Phospholipids, among the lipids, not all lipids have this quality, but phospholipids are important for life because they are amphipathic. Now, what does that word mean? Yes, it means being both hydrophilic and hydrophobic, depending on where you are on the particle. Amphi means dual. Pathic refers to feeling or preference. So it really means dual preference. Phospholipids have this nature. So the phosphate end of that, which is in the cartoon form, the globular head, those are hydrophilic molecules, which hydrophilic means polar, right? Either polar, which means partially charged, or even fully charged. Either a partially charged or a fully charged particle is polar. It has either a slight negative or a slight positive charge. The two tails shown in green in this cartoon form are those are the hydrophobic parts. They do not want to be around water, which is what hydrophobic literally means. The hydrophilic heads want to be around water because water itself is polar. And this is why they assemble this way. The green tails, which are hydrophobic, are trying to avoid the water. The way they do that is by grouping together so that they're next to each other, no problem. Tails in one monolayer to tails in the other monolayer, which means the head in each monolayer, the head region is going to be in direct contact with water, no problem. Water outside and water inside. This is how the first cell came into existence, which is what we owe our life to. And that's why you can't overstate the importance of phospholipids. But like I said, you need the help of all the macromolecules, not just phospholipids. Anyway, we'll talk more about membranes later. In slide 14, we're looking at the dichotomy of cell types. A dichotomy is a two-part way of looking at things. So any given cell is a member of either one type or another, the eukaryotic cells and the prokaryotic cells. And the karyo part of that word, the root of that word, which comes from karyon, it means kernel, or core or center. The kernel of a cell, if it has one, is the nucleus. So that's the basis of the etymology of the word. Eu means true. So eukaryotic literally means having a true nucleus, whereas prokaryotic means before the nucleus, meaning this thing came into existence before the nucleus arrived on the scene evolutionarily. So prokaryotic cells do not have a true nucleus. Eukaryotic cells do. That's the basis for the names of them, but that's not the only difference. A nucleus is an example of a membrane-bounded organelle. But there are other membrane-bounded organelles. Well, a eukaryotic cell not only has a nucleus, but it has other membrane-bounded organelles. Conversely, a prokaryotic cell has no true nucleus, but it also doesn't have any other membrane-bounded organelles. And by the way, there's a difference between the phrases membrane-bounded and membrane-bound. Membrane-bounded means bounded by a membrane. In other words, enclosed by a membrane. The membrane is forming a boundary. Whereas membrane-bound, bound here means past tense of bind. So it means tied to a membrane. It's part of a membrane. So there are proteins, for instance, that we call membrane-bound proteins. Those are proteins that are in part of the membrane. A membrane-bounded organelle is an organelle that has its own membrane enclosing it. All right. Well, you don't find those in prokaryotic cells. Any cell that's going to be able to transcribe or self-replicate, which is just about any cell that's living, is of course going to have DNA. That's true for prokaryotic cells for the same reason as in eukaryotic cells. Well, in eukaryotic cells, you find the DNA in the nucleus, as I'm sure you remember. But there is no nucleus in a prokaryotic cell, despite the fact that there is DNA. So that brings up a somewhat confusing word, which you shouldn't be confused by. I'm just telling you not to misread this. The nucleoid is the region in a prokaryotic cell where you find its DNA. Nucleoid literally means like a nucleus, right? The oid suffix means like. So it's nucleus-like except for the absence of the membrane. The point here is that the DNA is confined to a little region within the overall cell. It's not just randomly dispersed throughout the entire cytoplasm. Cytoplasm, by the way, is the stuff inside a prokaryotic cell collectively. And that's because a prokaryotic cell, having only one membrane, its own plasma membrane, has only one compartment. That compartment is filled with cytoplasm. A eukaryotic cell, on the other hand, has multiple compartments because it has multiple membranes. And so you can think of it as having two major compartments, which can then be subdivided, but the two major compartments are the nucleoplasm, which is everything inside the nuclear envelope, the membrane that defines the nucleus. And then everything that's outside of the nucleus but still inside the cell is the cytoplasm in a eukaryotic cell. Okay? So in the cartoon forms, you see these other membranes forming these other kinds of membrane-bounded organelles that you've learned about in at least one class, probably both of the prerequisites. Slide 15 shows you that in just very basic cartoon form that a plasma membrane is more than just a phospholipid bilayer. The phospholipid bilayer is the substructure on which other things are built. But if cells had nothing but a phospholipid bilayer as the plasma membrane, they would be in trouble because the phospholipid bilayer is a boundary that allows certain things, but only certain things, through it. What are the two major things that matter as to whether something can get through a phospholipid bilayer? Polarity and size, right. So things that are too big or too polar don't easily pass through the phospholipid bilayer. Now, this is the basis for life, in a sense, because it allows for the formation of a cell, which means that now you can have one aqueous solution, the intracellular fluid, that's chemically different from the surroundings, which is the extracellular fluid, another aqueous solution. And therefore, it's like a little test tube, really. Life is just chemistry. Life is just the chemical reactions that are happening in cells. And those are acting like little test tubes, really, apart from the rest of the universe. And speaking in terms of thermodynamics, there are what we call thermodynamic systems. A thermodynamic system can be just about anything you want to define it as. For instance, I am a system. I could also say just my kidney is a system. Well, I have two. Or just one of my cells is a system. Anything you want to say. A coffee cup is a system. But it's a defined thing. You define a system. Whatever you want to say it is. It's arbitrary, but you do define it. When you do define a system, though, that breaks the universe into two parts. The system itself and the surroundings, everything else in the universe. And thermodynamically, we can distinguish, and we'll talk more about this in energy chapters, but there are three kinds of thermodynamic systems: open systems, closed systems, and isolated systems. Well, organisms have to be open systems, open thermodynamic systems, because an open system is one that is able to exchange both materials and energy with the surroundings. Just to give you quick definitions of the other, just to make the sense of this, we'll talk more about it, like I said, later. A closed system is a system that there is no exchange of matter between the surroundings and the system, but there can be energy exchange. And an isolated system means no exchange of matter or energy, which never really exists. There's no such thing as a truly isolated system. Anyway, organisms have to be open systems because in order to live, in order to metabolize, there always has to be an exchange of materials and energy with the environment. You have to bring things in, you have to get rid of things, material things, and you obviously there's a bunch of energy transactions that occur, so you have to exchange energy with the surroundings as well. So this wouldn't be possible if the only things allowed to pass through the membrane, either into or out of a cell, were just things that were small and hydrophobic. Those things can get right through the plasma membrane, the phospholipid bilayer. But there's all kinds of other things that you need to get through the membrane as well, and that's why you don't have a plasma membrane consisting entirely of phospholipids. You also have a bunch of other things in there, chiefly proteins, which are what these big blobs are. The yellow and the blue things are proteins. All kinds of membrane-bound proteins that give a plasma membrane the correct selective permeability for that cell. Selective permeability refers not only to the fact that not just anything can get through. So the word semi-permeable is often used to mean things. Some things get through, some things don't. Selective permeability means just the right things get through and the wrong things don't. At least that's what the cell is trying to achieve. All right, well, let's quickly go through the other membrane-bounded organelles besides the nucleus that you've all learned about before. Oh, well, actually, here in 16, we're looking at a plant cell. It really has all the things that an animal cell has in terms of its membrane-bounded organelles, but it has ones that you won't find in animal cells, and those, of course, are the chloroplasts, which are the organelles of photosynthesis. But there's also a big difference other than that, and that's, of course, the appearance of a cell wall exterior to the plasma membrane. Every cell has a plasma membrane. That's what defines the cell. But certain species have cell walls outside of the plasma membranes. Plants have this. Bacteria have cell walls. Fungi have cell walls. Animals don't, though. Let's look at 17 now and look at what's going on here. Well, you see a bunch of membrane-bounded organelles, but also the main point of this slide is that the cytoplasm has a very high degree of structure to it. So cells are not just bags. The cytosol, which is the liquid part of cytoplasm, it is an aqueous solution. But that doesn't mean that the cell is just a bag of solution that stuff can slosh around in any direction. There's a high degree of order to the cytoplasm because of major classes of proteins that exist in what we call the cytoskeleton, the skeleton of the cell, literally. So we have microtubules, intermediate filaments, and microfilaments making up, those are the three major classes of proteins making up the cytoskeleton that gives order to the overall cytoplasm and also provides ways for moving things from one place in the cell to the next, to another within the cell, including organelles themselves. But we'll talk more about that a bit later as well. Slide 18 shows you a photomicrograph of a nucleus. It's the biggest organelle in a eukaryotic cell. There's usually just one. The nucleus, of course, is where the DNA is. Nucleus is not only a membrane-bounded organelle, but it's a multiply membrane-bounded organelle. There are two membrane layers. to what we call the overall nuclear envelope. Each layer is itself a bilayer because any biological membrane, whether it's the plasma membrane or the membrane for any organelle, is itself a bilayer of phospholipids. But when I say that it's doubly membrane-bounded, the nucleus, that is, I mean that there are two bilayers, an exterior one and an interior one. And you can see those as dark lines here. Each line is really two monolayers forming a phospholipid bilayer. But anyway, it's big and conspicuous if you're looking at a eukaryotic cell. In 19, we're not looking at a cell in cartoon form here, even though it looks like a cell. We're looking at a mitochondrion, which is another example of a multiply membrane-bounded organelle. There are two membranes to a mitochondrion as well, an outer and an inner. This goes along well with the almost certain fact that these organelles evolved, came to be in the process of endosymbiosis. They were prokaryotes living on them, living alone, and then got engulfed by a proto-eukaryote. But anyway, there's just like an overall cell has multiple membranes, any organelle that has multiple membranes also has multiple compartments. So the mitochondrial organelle is broken into matrix and intermembrane space because of those two membranes, right? This is stuff you remember from 181, right? What's the major job of the mitochondrion? Cellular respiration. In 20, we're looking at an endoplasmic reticulum. Reticulum means small network. So there's actually many membranes involved in forming little sac-like structures, but the collection of all of those are called the endoplasmic reticulum. Some of the membrane is continuous with the outer membrane of the nuclear envelope. So that's the nucleus. This is the nuclear envelope up here, and parts of the outer part, outer membrane, fold outwardly and become part of the endoplasmic reticulum. And I'm sure you remember that the endoplasmic reticulum as a whole is broken into smooth and rough components, which don't only look different, hence their names, but have different functions. What's the major function of the smooth endoplasmic reticulum? There's several functions, but lipid synthesis, good, right. That's a major function, and so is storage of various things, including calcium ions, which are important signals in cells. It's important to keep signals sequestered until they are needed to operate as signals, in which case they're released. So the smooth endoplasmic reticulum is busy pumping calcium ions from the cytosol into the lumen of itself for them to be released later. This is how your muscles work, for instance. The rough endoplasmic reticulum is called rough endoplasmic reticulum because of the presence of bound ribosomes on the surface, which are the little green things here. Any ribosome that is busy doing the job of translation starts out as a ribosome when the two subunits come together. That starts out in the cytosol. But in certain cases, for certain proteins that are being translated, that ribosome and all the other stuff associated with it are going to be brought over to the surface of the rough endoplasmic reticulum so that the newly made polypeptide is strung into the lumen of the rough ER for it to undergo modification, which is the major job of the rough ER, to modify newly made polypeptides and then send them on their way via vesicles, little pieces of little sacs made out of membrane that bud off of the endoplasmic reticulum and get sent to the nearby organelle called the Golgi complex. So I have to quit there.